I've got something. Before I know which ones I like. Mia looked around at the photographs, as if they were old friends, and she was reminding herself of their faces. Mrs. Richardson peered closely at a photo of a sullen young girl in a cowgirl outfit. Mia had snapped it at a parade they'd passed on the way into Ohio. "You have such a gift for portraiture," she said. "Look at the way you've captured this little girl. You can almost see right down into her soul." Mia said nothing, but nodded in a way Mrs. Richardson decided was modesty. "You should consider taking portraits professionally," Mrs. Richardson suggested. She paused. "Not that you're not a professional already, of course, but in a studio, maybe. Or for weddings and engagements. You'd be very highly sought after." She waved a hand at the photographs on the wall as if they could articulate what she meant. "In fact, perhaps you could take portraits of our family. I pay you, of course." "Perhaps," Mia said. "But the thing about portraits is you need to show people the way they want to be seen. And I prefer to show people as I see them. So in the end, I'd probably just frustrate us both." She smiled placidly, and Mrs. Richardson fumbled for a response. "Is any of your work for sale?" she asked. "I have a friend in New York who runs a gallery, and she's sold some of my prints." Mia ran a finger along one photograph, tracing the curve of a rusted bridge. "Well, I'd love to buy one," Mrs. Richardson said. "In fact, I insist. If we don't support our artists, how can they create great work?" "That's very generous of you." Mia's eyes slid toward the window briefly, and Mrs. Richardson felt a twinge of irritation at this lukewarm response to her philanthropy. "Do you sell enough to get by?" she asked. Mia correctly interpreted this as a question about rent and her ability to pay it. "We've always gotten by," she said. "One way or another." "But surely there must be times when photographs don't sell. Through no fault of your own, of course. And how much does a photograph typically sell for?" "We've always gotten by," Mia said again. "I take side jobs when I need to. House cleaning or cooking. Things like that. I'm working part-time at Lucky Palace now, that Chinese restaurant over on Warrensville. I've never had a debt I didn't pay." "Oh, of course I wasn't implying that," Mrs. Richardson protested. She turned her attention to the largest print, which had been stuck up alone over the mantelpiece. It was a photograph of a woman, back to the camera, in mid-dance. The film caught her in blurred motion. Arms everywhere, stretched high, to her sides, curved to her waist. A tangle of limbs that Mrs. Richardson realized with a shock made her resemble an enormous spider, surrounded by a haze of web. It perturbed and perplexed her, but she could not turn away. "I never thought of making a woman into a spider," she said truthfully. Artists, she reminded herself, didn't think like normal people. And at last, she turned to Mia with curiosity. She had never before met anyone like her. Mrs. Richardson had, her entire existence, lived an orderly and regimented life. She weighed herself once per week, and although her weight did not fluctuate more than the 3 pounds her doctor assured her was normal, she took pains to maintain herself. Each morning, she measured exactly 1/2 cup of Cheerios, the serving size indicated on the box, using the flowered plastic measuring cup she'd gotten from Higby's as a new bride. Each evening, at dinner, she allowed herself 1 glass of wine, red, which the news said was most beneficial for your heart, a faint scratch in the wine glass marking the right level to pour. 3 times weekly, she took an aerobics class, checking her watch throughout to be sure her heart rate had exceeded 120 beats per minute. She had been brought up to follow rules, to believe that the proper functioning of the world depended upon her compliance, and follow them and believe she did. She had had a plan from girlhood on and had followed it scrupulously. High school, college, boyfriend, marriage, job, mortgage, children. A sedan with airbags and automatic seatbelts. A lawnmower and a snowblower. A matching washer and dryer. She had, in short, done everything right, and she had built a good life, the kind of life she wanted, the kind of life everyone wanted. Now, here was this Mia, a completely different kind of woman leading a completely different life, who seemed to make her own rules with no apologies. Like the photograph of the spider dancer. Mrs. Richardson found this perturbing, but strangely compelling. A part of her wanted to study Mia like an anthropologist, to understand why and how she did what she did. Another part of her, though she was only vaguely aware of it at the moment, was uneasy, wanted to keep an eye on Mia, as you might keep your eye on a dangerous beast. "You keep everything so clean," she said at last, running a finger along the mantelpiece. "I should hire you to come to our house." She laughed, and Mia echoed it politely. But she could see the seed of an idea cracking and sprouting in Mrs. Richardson's mind. "Wouldn't that be perfect?" Mrs. Richardson said. "You could come just for a few hours a day and do a little light housekeeping. I pay you for your time, of course. And then you'd have all the rest of your day to take pictures." Mia began searching for the right, delicate words to uproot this idea, but it was too late. Mrs. Richardson had already latched onto it with vigor. "Now, really, why don't you come and work for us? We had a woman who came to clean and do some dinner prep before, but she went back home to Atlanta in the spring, and I could certainly use the help. You'd be doing me a favor, really." She turned around to face Mia squarely. "In fact, I insist. You must have time for your art." Mia could see there was no point in protesting. That protesting, in fact, would only make things worse and lead to ill will. She had learned that when people were bent on doing something they believed was a good deed, it was usually impossible to dissuade them. She thought with dismay of the Richardsons, of the vast and gleaming Richardson house, of Pearl's face when her mother dared set foot on this precious soil. And then she imagined herself safely installed in the Richardson's kingdom, half obscured in the background, keeping watch over her daughter, reasserting her presence in her daughter's life. "Thank you," she said. "That's so very generous of you to offer. How could I refuse?" And Mrs. Richardson beamed. 7. The arrangements were soon settled. In exchange for $300 a month, Mia would vacuum, dust, and tidy the Richardson house 3 times a week and prepare dinner nightly. It seemed an excellent deal, just a few hours of work per day for the equivalent of their rent. But Pearl was displeased. "Why did she ask you?" she demanded with a groan. And Mia bit her tongue and reminded herself that her daughter was, after all, 15. "Because she's trying to be nice to us," she retorted. And thankfully, Pearl let the subject drop. But inside, she was furious at the thought of Mia invading what she thought of as her space, the Richardson house. Her mother would be just a few yards away in the kitchen, hearing everything, observing everything. The afternoons on the couch, the joking she'd come to feel a part of, even the ridiculous ritual of watching Jerry Springer. Everything would be ruined. Just days before, she'd worked up the courage to swat Tripp's hand when he'd made a joke about her pants. "Why so many pockets?" he demanded. "What are you hiding in there?" First he'd patted the pockets at the sides of her knees, then those at her hips. Then, when he'd reached for the ones on her rear, she'd smacked him. And to her smitten delight, he'd said, "Don't be mad. You know I love you." And put his arm around her shoulder. With her mother there, though, she would never dare such a thing. And neither, she suspected, would Trip. Mr. Richardson, too, found the new arrangements awkward. It was one thing, he thought, to hire a housekeeper. It was another to hire someone they already knew, the mother of one of their children's friends. But Mrs. Richardson, he could see, felt it was a generous gesture. So instead of arguing, he made a point of speaking to Mia on her first morning in the house. "We're very grateful for your help," he told her, as she pulled the bucket of cleaning supplies from under the sink. "It's a huge, huge help to us." Mia smiled and reached for a bottle of Windex and said nothing, and Mr. Richardson cast about for something else to say. "How do you like Shaker?" "It's quite a place." Mia sprayed the counter and swept the sponge across it, corralling crumbs into the sink. "Did you grow up in Shaker, too?"
"No, just Elena," Mr. Richardson shook his head. "I'd never even heard of Shaker Heights before I met her."
Their first week at Denison, he had fallen for the ardent young woman collecting signatures around campus to end the draft. By the time they graduated, he had fallen for Shaker Heights as well, the way Elena described it. The first planned community, the most progressive community, the perfect place for young idealists. In his own little hometown, they'd been suspicious of ideas. He'd grown up surrounded by a kind of resigned cynicism, though he'd been sure the world could be better. It was why he'd been so eager to leave, and why he'd been smitten as soon as they'd met. Northwestern had been his first choice. He'd been turned down, had settled for the only school that let him leave the state. But once he'd met Elena, it had seemed, to him, like fate intervening. Elena was determined to return to her hometown after school. And the more she told him about it, the more willing he was. It seemed only natural to him that such a place would have formed his principled fiancée, who always strove for perfection, and he gladly followed her back to Shaker Heights after graduation. Now, almost 2 decades later, well settled in their careers and their family and their lives, as he filled up his BMW with premium gas or cleaned his golf clubs or signed a permission form for his children to go skiing, those college days seemed fuzzy and distant as old Polaroids. Elena, too, had mellowed. Of course, she still donated to charity and voted Democrat, but so many years of comfortable suburban living had changed both of them. Neither of them had ever been radical, even at a time of protests, sit-ins, marches, riots. But now they owned 2 houses, 4 cars, a small boat they docked at the marina downtown. They had someone to plow the snow in the winter and mow the lawn in the summer. And, of course, they'd had a housekeeper for years, a long string of them. And now here was the newest, this young woman in his kitchen, waiting for him to leave so she could clean his house. He recollected himself, smiled bashfully, picked up his briefcase. At the doorway to the garage, he paused. "If working here ever stops suiting your needs, please let me know. There will be no hard feelings, I promise." Mia soon settled into a schedule. She arrived in the morning at 8:30, soon after everyone had gone off to work or school, and would be finished by 10. Then she would go home to her camera, returning at 5 o'clock to cook. "There's no need to make 2 trips," Mrs. Richardson had pointed out. But Mia had insisted midday was the best time for her photography. The truth was that she wanted to study the Richardsons both when they were there and when they weren't. Every day, it seemed, Pearl absorbed something new from the Richardson family, a turn of phrase. "I was literally dying." A gesture, a flick of the hair, an eye roll. She was a teen, Mia told herself over and over. She was trying on new skins, like all teenagers did. But privately, she stayed wary of the changes she saw. Now, every afternoon, she would be there to check on Pearl, to observe these Richardsons who fascinated her daughter so. Every morning, she would be free to investigate on her own. In the course of her cleaning, Mia began to observe carefully. She knew when Tripp had failed a math test by the shredded scraps in his trash bin, when Moody had been writing songs by the crumpled wads of paper in his. She knew that no one in the Richardson family ate the crust of the pizza or brown-spotted bananas, that Lexi had a weakness for gossip magazines and, based on her bookshelf, Charles Dickens, that Mr. Richardson liked to eat those cream-filled caramel bullseyes by the bagful while he worked in his study at night. By the time she finished an hour and a half later, the house tidy, she had a very good sense of what each member of the family was doing. This was how, a week into her new duties, Mia came to be in the Richardson kitchen when Izzy wandered downstairs at 9:30 in the morning. The day before, Izzy had startled but not surprised her family by being suspended from school. In the middle of orchestra, she had, according to the freshman vice principal, broken the teacher's bow over her knee and thrown the pieces in the teacher's face. Despite repeated questionings and stern talking tos both at school and at home, she had refused to say anything about what had caused this outburst. It was, as Lexi put it, vintage Izzy. Freak out for no reason, do something crazy, learn nothing from it. Consequently, after a hasty meeting with her mother, the principal, and the aggrieved orchestra teacher, she had been suspended from school for 3 days. Mia was cleaning the stove when Izzy stomped in, somehow clomping in bare feet as loudly as she did in her Doc Martens, and stopped. "Oh," she said. "It's you, the indentured servant. I mean, the tenant-slash-cleaning lady." Mia had heard a third-hand version of events from Pearl the day before. "I'm Mia," she said. "I'm guessing you're Izzy?" Izzy settled herself onto a bar stool.
"The crazy one."
Mia wiped the counter carefully. "No one said anything like that to me." She rinsed the sponge and set it in its holder to dry. Izzy lapsed into silence and Mia began to scour the sink. When she had finished, she turned on the boiler. Then she took a piece of bread from the loaf in the bread box, spread it with butter and sprinkled it thickly with sugar, and set it in the oven until the sugar had melted to a bubbling, golden caramel. She set another piece of bread on top, cut the sandwich in two, and set it in front of Izzy. A suggestion, not a command. It was something she did sometimes for Pearl when she was having what Mia called a low day. Izzy, who had been watching silently but with interest, said nothing, but pulled the plate toward her. In her experience, when someone tried to do something for her, it came from either pity or distrust. But this simple gesture felt like what it was. A small kindness, with no strings attached. When she had finished the last bite of sandwich, she licked butter from her fingers and looked up.
"So you want to hear what happened?"
she asked, and the whole story emerged. The orchestra teacher, Mrs. Peters, was widely disliked by everyone. She was a tall, painfully thin woman with hair dyed an unnatural flaxen and cropped in a manner reminiscent of Dorothy Hamill. According to Izzy, she was useless as a conductor, and everyone knew to just watch Carrie Schulman, the first chair violin for the tempo. A persistent rumor, after some years calcified as fact, insisted that Mrs. Peters had a drinking problem. Izzy hadn't entirely believed it, until Mrs. Peters had borrowed her violin one morning to demonstrate a bowing. When she'd handed it back, the chin rest damp with sweat, it had smelled unmistakably of whiskey. When she brought her big camping thermos of coffee, people said you knew Mrs. Peters had been on a bender the night before. Moreover, she was often bitingly sarcastic, especially to the second violins. Especially the ones who, as one of the cellos put it dryly, were pigmentally blessed. Stories about her had filtered down to Izzy even in middle school. Izzy, who had been playing violin since she was 4 and had been assigned second chair even though she was a freshman, should have had nothing to fear. "You'll be fine," the cello had told her, eyeing Izzy's frizzy golden hair. "The dandelion fro," Lexi liked to call it. Had Izzy kept her head down, Mrs. Peters would likely have ignored her. But Izzy was not the type to keep her head down. The morning of her suspension, Izzy had been in her seat, practicing a tricky fingering on the E string for the Saint-Saëns piece she'd been working on in her private lessons. Around her, the hum of violas and cellos tuning up grew quiet as Mrs. Peters stormed in, thermos in hand. It was clear from the start that she was in an extraordinarily foul mood. She snapped at Shanita Grimes to spit out her gum. She barked at Jesse Leibovitz, who had just broken her A string and was fishing in her case for a replacement.
"Hangover,"
Carrie Schulman mouthed to Izzy, who nodded gravely. She had only a general sense of what this meant. A few times Tripp had come home from hockey parties and had seemed, she thought, extra dense and groggy in the morning, even for Tripp,
but she knew it involved headaches and ill temper. She tapped the tip of her bow against her boots. At the podium, Mrs. Peters took a long swig from her mug of coffee. "Offenbach," she barked, raising her right hand. Around the room, students rifled through their sheet music. 12 bars into Orpheus, Mrs. Peters waved her arms. "Someone's off." She pointed her bow at Deja Johnson, who was at the back of the second violins. "Deja, play from measure 6. Deja, who everyone knew was painfully shy, glanced up with the look of a frightened rabbit. She began to play, and everyone could hear the slight tremor from her shaking hand. Mrs. Peters shook her head and wrapped her bow on her stand. "Wrong bowing. Down. Up, up, down, up. Again." Deja stumbled through the piece again. The room simmered with resentment, but no one said anything. Mrs. Peters took a long slurp of coffee. "Stand up, Deja. Nice and loud now, so everyone can hear what they're not supposed to be doing." The edges of Deja's mouth wobbled, as if she were going to cry, but she set her bow to string and began once more. Mrs. Peters shook her head again, her voice shrill over the single violin. "Deja, down, up, up, down, up. Did you not understand me? You need me to speak in Ebonics?" It was at this point that Izzy had jumped from her seat and grabbed Mrs. Peters' bow. She could not say, even when telling Mia the story, why she had reacted so strongly. It was partly that Deja Johnson always had the anxious face of someone expecting the worst. Everyone knew that her mother was an RN. In fact, she worked with Serena Wong's mother down at the Cleveland Clinic, and her father managed a warehouse on the west side. There weren't many black kids in the orchestra, though, and when her parents showed up for concerts, they sat in the last row by themselves. They never chit-chatted with the other parents about skiing or remodeling or plans for spring break. They had lived all of Deja's life in a comfortable little house at the south end of Shaker, and she had gone from kindergarten all the way up to high school without, as people joked, saying more than 10 words a year. But unlike many of the other violinists who resented Izzy for making second chair her first year, Deja never joined in the snide comments or called her the freshman. In the first week of school, Deja, as they filed out of the orchestra room, had leaned over to zip an unfastened pocket on Izzy's book bag, concealing her exposed gym clothes. A few weeks later, Izzy had been digging through her bag, desperately looking for a tampon, when Deja had discreetly leaned across the aisle and extended a folded hand. "Here," she'd said, and Izzy had known what it was before she even felt the crinkle of the plastic wrapper in her palm. Watching Mrs. Peters pick on Deja in front of everyone had been like watching someone drag a kitten into the street and club it with a brick. And something inside Izzy had snapped. Before she knew it, she had cracked Mrs. Peters' bow over her knee and flung the broken pieces at her. There had been a sudden squawk from Mrs. Peters as the jagged halves of the bow, still joined by the horsehair, had whipped across her face, and a shrill squeal as the mug of steaming coffee in her hand tipped down her front. The practice room had erupted in a babble of laughter and shrieking and hooting, and Mrs. Peters, coffee dripping down the tendons of her neck, had grabbed Izzy by the elbow and dragged her from the room. In the principal's office, waiting for her mother to arrive, Izzy had wondered if Deja had been pleased or embarrassed, and she wished she'd had a chance to see Deja's face. Although Izzy was sure now that Mia would understand all of this, she did not know how to put everything she felt into words. She said only, "Mrs. Peters is a total bitch. She had no right to say that to Deja." "Well," said Mia, "what are you going to do about it?" It was not a question Izzy had been asked before. Until now, her life had been one of mute, futile fury. In the first week of school, after reading T.S. Eliot, she had tacked up signs on all the bulletin boards. "I have measured out my life with coffee spoons, and do I dare to eat a peach? And do I dare disturb the universe?" The poem made her think of her mother,
doling out her creamer in a precise teaspoon, flipping out about pesticides if Izzy bit into an apple without washing it, rigidly drawing restrictions around her every move, and made her think of her older siblings, too, of Lexi and Tripp and everyone like them, which to Izzy felt like everyone. So concerned about wearing the right things, saying the right things, being friends with the right people. She had fantasies of students whispering in the halls. Those signs? Who put them up? What do they mean? Noticing them, thinking about them, waking up, for God's sake. But in the rush before first period, everyone funneled past them up and down the stairwells, too busy passing notes and cramming for quizzes to even glance up at the bulletin boards. And after second period, she found that some dour security guard had torn the signs down, no doubt perplexed by these misses, leaving only flyers for Youth Ending Hunger, Model UN, and French Club. The second week of school, when Ms. Bellamy had asked them to memorize a poem and recite it in front of the class, Izzy had selected This Be the Verse, a poem she felt, based on her 14 and a half years, summed up life quite accurately. She got no further than, "They fuck you up, your mum and dad," before Ms. Bellamy had peremptorily told her to sit down and given her a zero. What was she going to do about it? The very idea that she could do something stunned her. At that moment, Lexi's car pulled into the driveway and Lexi came in, book bag slung over one shoulder, smelling of cigarette smoke and CK1. "Thank God, there it is," she said, plucking her wallet off the edge of the counter. Lexi, Mrs. Richardson liked to say, would leave her head at home if it weren't attached. "Having fun on your vacation day?" she said to Izzy, and Mia saw a light in Izzy switch off. "Thanks for the sandwich," she said, and slid down from her stool and went upstairs. "Jesus," Lexi said, rolling her eyes. "I will never understand that girl." She looked at Mia, waiting for a sympathetic nod, but it didn't come. "Drive carefully," was all Mia said, and Lexi bounced out, wallet in hand, and in a moment, her Explorer revved outside. Izzy had the heart of a radical, but she had the experience of a 14-year-old living in the suburban Midwest, which was to say, she cast about for ideas for exacting revenge, egged windows, flaming bags of dog shit, and chose the best thing in her limited repertoire. 3 afternoons later, Pearl and Moody were in the living room watching Ricky Lake when they saw Izzy stride calmly down the hallway, a 6-pack of toilet paper under each arm. They exchanged a single, hasty glance, and then, without discussion, chased after her. "You are a freaking idiot," Moody said, when they had intercepted Izzy in the foyer and safely barricaded her in the kitchen. Over the years, he had saved Izzy from her own stupidity, as he thought of it, a number of times. But this, for him, was a new record. TPing her house? "It's a bitch to clean up," Izzy said. "It'll piss her off, and she deserves to be pissed off." "And she'll know it was you, the girl she just suspended." Moody kicked the toilet paper under the table. "If you don't get caught in the act, which you probably would have." Izzy scowled. "You have a better idea?" "You can't just target Mrs. Peters," Mia said. All three children looked up in astonishment. They had forgotten, for a moment, that Mia was there. Yet there she was, chopping a pepper for dinner and sounding like no parent they'd ever encountered. Pearl flushed and shot a glance at her mother. What was she thinking, butting in like this? Let alone butting into this conversation, of all things. What Mia was thinking about, however, was her own teenage years, memories she'd packed away long ago for safekeeping, but now unfolded and dusted clean. "Someone I knew once glued the lock on the history teacher's door," she said. He'd been late, and she'd given him detention, and he'd missed playing in a big football game. The next day, he squirted a whole tube of crazy glue into the lock. They had to break down the door. A faraway smile crept over her mouth. But he only did hers, so they knew it was him right away. He got grounded for a month. "Mom," Pearl's entire face was aflame. "Thanks. We've got this."
Hastily, she nudged Izzy and Moody out of the kitchen and out of Mia's earshot. Now they would think her mother was a total nutcase, she thought, unable to even look at them. Had she glanced at their faces, though, she would have seen not derision, but admiration. From the gleam in Mia's eye, both Moody and Izzy could see she was far savvier and far more interesting than they'd imagined. It was their first clue, they would realize later, that there was another side to her. All evening, Izzy turned over Mia's story, her question from before. What are you going to do about it? In those words, she heard a permission to do what she'd always been told not to. To take matters into her own hands. To make trouble. By this point, Izzy's anger had ballooned to cover not only Mrs. Peters, but the principal who'd hired her, the vice principal who had handed out the suspension, every teacher, every adult who'd ever cudgeled a student with arbitrary, unearned power. The next day, she cornered Moody and Pearl and outlined her plan. "It's going to piss her off," said Izzy. "It's going to piss everyone off." "You're going to get in trouble," Moody protested. But Izzy shook her head. "I'm doing this," she said. "I'm only going to get in trouble if you don't help me." A toothpick, inserted into a standard keyhole and snapped off flush, is a marvelous thing. It causes no damage to the lock, yet it prevents the key from entering so the door cannot be opened. It is not easily removed without a pair of needle-nose tweezers, which are often not handy and take some time to procure. The more impatient the key wielder, the more firmly and insistently the key is jammed into the keyhole, the more tenaciously the toothpick will cling to the innards of the lock, and the longer it will take to extract it, even with the right equipment. A reasonably adept teenager, working quickly, can insert a toothpick into a lock, snap it off, and walk away in approximately 3 seconds. Three teenagers, working in unison, can therefore immobilize an entire high school containing 126 doors in less than 10 minutes, quickly enough to avoid notice and settle into their usual spots in the hallway to watch what ensues. By the time the first teachers noticed their doors were jammed, it was already 7:27. By 7:40, when most of the teachers arrived at their classrooms and found themselves stymied, Mr. Wrigley, the custodian, was upstairs in the science wing attempting to pry the first sliver of toothpick out of the chemistry lab's lock with the tip of his penknife. By 7:45, when Mr. Wrigley returned to his office in search of his toolbox and the tweezers inside it, he found a large crowd of teachers clustered in his doorway, clamoring about the jammed locks. In the confusion, someone dislodged the doorstop that had been holding Mr. Wrigley's door open and let it slam shut, and Mr. Wrigley finally discovered the toothpick that Izzy herself had carefully placed in his keyhole much earlier when he had stepped out for a mug of coffee. All this time, students had been trickling in. First, the early birds, who came at 7:15 to secure a parking spot on the oval that surrounded the school. Then the students who got dropped off by parents or walked. By the time the late arrivals straggled in at 7:52 and the bell for first period was ringing, the hallways were crammed with gleeful students, bewildered secretaries, and furious teachers. It would be another 20 minutes before Mr. Wrigley returned from his truck, having rummaged in the toolbox in the trunk and finally, to his immense relief, found a second pair of tweezers. It would be another 10 minutes after that when he managed to extract the first toothpick from the first classroom door and the chemistry teacher could at last get to his desk. Morning announcements were postponed, replaced by stern instructions over the PA system that all students were to line up outside their first period classes, which no one heard. The atmosphere in every hallway was like that of a surprise party, with no host in evidence, but everyone somehow as a surprised and delighted guest. From a locker, someone produced a boombox, complete with batteries. Andre Williams, the kicker of the football team, extended the antenna, hoisted it onto his shoulder, and clicked the dial to WMMS, Buzzard Radio, and an impromptu dance party to the Mighty Mighty Bosstones erupted before Mrs. Allerton, the U.S. history teacher, reached him and told him to shut it off.
Mr. Wrigley continued to work his way down the hallway, one door at a time, prying splinters of wood from the Yale locks and gathering them in his calloused palm. Down in the arts wing, Mrs. Peters, nursing her extra-large thermos and a splitting headache, began to fidget. The orchestra room was far from the science wing, where Mr. Wrigley was slowly progressing. At this rate, hers would be one of the last, if not the last, door to be unjammed. She had asked Mr. Wrigley several times if he couldn't go faster, if he couldn't take a moment and open her door first, and by the third time, he turned to her, brandishing a scrap of wood in his upturned tweezers. "I'm going as fast as I can, Mrs. Peters," he said. "Going as fast as I can. Everybody's got to wait their turn." He turned back to the keyhole before him, where Mr. DeSanti, the ninth-grade math teacher, had tried to force his key into the lock and splintered the toothpick deep into the cylinders. "Everybody got to be first," he muttered loud enough to be sure Mrs. Peters would hear. "Everybody gotta be important. Well, the man with the tweezers says everybody gotta wait their turn." He thrust the tweezers into the lock again, and Mrs. Peters turned away. That had been an hour and a half ago, and she suspected, accurately, that Mr. Wrigley was holding her room for last to punish her. Fine, she thought, but couldn't he at least open up the faculty lounge? She had checked three times now, and the door was still locked. With every minute that passed, she became more aware of the full thermos of coffee, almost an entire potful, she'd emptied while waiting. The girls' bathrooms had swinging doors, unlockable. Surely she would not have to go in there with the students, she thought. Surely he would open the faculty lounge soon, and she could use the unisex restroom there, the one reserved for teachers. As each minute ticked by, her impatience with Mr. Wrigley grew and spread to the principal, to the entire world. Couldn't anyone think ahead? Couldn't anyone prioritize? Couldn't anyone take basic human needs into account? She gave up her post by the orchestra room and took up a new waiting spot outside the faculty lounge, her handbag clutched across her abdomen like a shield. 5 cups of coffee trickled their slow way through her innards. For a few moments, she considered simply getting into her car and driving away. She could be home in 25 minutes. But the longer she stood, the longer 25 minutes seemed, and the more certain it seemed to her that sitting, in any context, would bring disaster. "Dr. Schwab," she said as the principal walked by, "can't you ask Mr. Wrigley to open the faculty lounge, please?" Dr. Schwab had had a difficult morning. It was 9:40, and half of the classrooms were still locked, although he'd asked teachers to bring their students into the classrooms and keep them there until all the doors had been opened. 800 students were still loose in the hallways. Some of them had spilled out onto the steps. Groups of them had formed circles on the lawn, laughing and kicking hacky sacks, and in some cases, even smoking right there on school property. He rubbed his temple with one knuckle. Beneath his collar, his neck began to chafe, and he wiggled a finger beneath his tie. "Helen," he said with as much patience as he could muster, "Mr. Wrigley is going as fast as he can. In the meantime, the girls' bathroom is right down the hall. I'm sure you can use it just this one time." He headed off, doing quick mental calculations. If everyone was back in the classrooms by 10:30, which seemed optimistic, they could run an abbreviated schedule with each period running 34 minutes instead of 50. Mrs. Peters waited another 15 minutes and then could wait no more. She squeezed the handles of her purse tighter, as if that would somehow help, and trotted down the hallway to the girls' bathroom. It was the main restroom, positioned right where the main hallway met the main staircase, and even on a normal day, it was crowded. Today, it was mobbed. A group of boys stood in a ring outside, smashing the apples from their lunches against their foreheads and egging each other on with guttural roars. A group of girls clustered around the water fountain, half of them pretending not to notice the boys, the other half of them flirting with the boys outright. Above them, a mural of a shark looked down with a gaping mouth. Mrs. Peters felt a brief pang of irritation at their youth, their frivolity, their ease.
On a normal day, she would have told them to move along or demanded hall passes from each one, but today she was in no condition to care. She elbowed her way through the crowd. "Excuse me, excuse me. Boys, girls, the teacher needs to get through." Inside, the bathroom was crammed with girls. Girls gossiping, girls fixing their hair, girls primping. Mrs. Peters nudged her way past with increasing urgency. "Excuse me, girls. Excuse me, girls." Every girl in the bathroom looked up, wide-eyed, at the intrusion. "Hi, Mrs. Peters," said Lexi. "I didn't know teachers ever used this bathroom." "The faculty lounge is still locked," Mrs. Peters said in what she hoped was a dignified tone. Around her, she noticed that all the girls had gone silent. In ordinary circumstances, she would have approved of the sign of respect, but today she would have preferred to be ignored. She turned and headed for the father's stall, by the window, but when she reached it, she found that it had no door. "What happened to the door?" she asked stupidly. "It's been broken forever," Lexi said. "Since the first week of school. They really ought to fix it. You come in here and there's only three stalls you can use and you end up being late for class." Mrs. Peters didn't bother to listen to the rest of Lexi's speech. She yanked the door of the next stall open and slammed it behind her. With trembling hands, she slid the latch into place and fumbled with her skirt. But at the sight of the white porcelain bowl, her body, which had been waiting for nearly 2.5 hours, could resist no longer. With a tremendous gush, her bladder gave way, and Mrs. Peters felt a warm rush flood down her legs, and a spreading puddle snaked its way across the tiles and out of the stall. From behind the flimsy partition, Mrs. Peters heard someone say, "Oh, my God." Then a shocked, utter silence. She held completely still, as if, she thought irrationally, the girls outside might simply forget about her. The silence seemed to stretch itself out like taffy. The damp patch on her skirt and her soaked pantyhose turned chilly. And then the giggling began. The kind of giggles that grew all the more obvious for being stifled. Bags were quickly zipped. Footsteps scurried into the hallway. Mrs. Peters heard the door swing open, then shut, and a few moments later she heard roars of laughter from the hallway. She stayed in the stall a long time, until she heard Dr. Schwab on the PA system informing everyone that all doors were now unlocked and all students should be in class or risk detention. When she came out into the bathroom again, it was empty, and she left concealing her stained skirt with her pocketbook, refusing to look at the puddle, which was slowly trickling past the sinks toward the drain in the corner. If anyone in second period orchestra rehearsal noticed that Mrs. Peters was wearing different clothing when class began at last, no one said a word. They practiced the Offenbach and the Barber and Mozart's 25th with blank faces. But the word had already spread. It would be days before, pausing outside the classroom, she heard someone refer to her as Mrs. Pissers. And it would be years, well past her retirement, before the nickname and story passed down from class to class faded away. The toothpick incident would have a lasting effect on the school as well. There were no cameras in the hallways, and no one seemed to have spotted the vandals, whoever they'd been. There was some talk of instituting better security. Several teachers mentioned nearby Euclid, which had recently made news for installing metal detectors at each entrance. But the general feeling was that Shaker Heights, unlike Euclid, should not need such security. And the administration decided to downplay the incident as a minor prank. In the minds of Shaker students, however, Toothpick Day would acquire the status of legend. And in future years, during senior prank week, toothpicks were banned from the school by threat of detention. The day after Toothpick Day, Izzy caught Deja Johnson's eye and smiled. And Deja, though she had no idea that this entire event had been on her behalf, and even less of an idea that Izzy Richardson was behind it, smiled back.
They wouldn't become friends, exactly, but Izzy would feel there was a bond between them. And every day in orchestra, she made a point of smiling at Deja Johnson, and noted with satisfaction that Mrs. Peters now left Deja alone. The toothpick's most lasting effect, however, turned out to be on Izzy herself. She kept thinking of Mia's smile that day in the kitchen, the capability she saw there to delight in mischief and breaking the rules. Her own mother would have been horrified. She recognized a kindred spirit, a similar subversive spark to the one she often felt flaring inside her. Instead of shutting herself up in her room all afternoon, she began to come down when Mia arrived and linger in the kitchen while she cooked, much to her siblings' amusement. Izzy ignored them. She was too fascinated by Mia to care. And then, a few days later, Mia answered the door of the little Winslow house to find Izzy outside. "I want to be your assistant," Izzy blurted out. "I don't need an assistant," Mia told her, "and I'm not sure your mother would like it." "I don't care," Izzy put her hand on the doorframe, as if afraid Mia might slam the door in her face. "I just want to learn about what you're doing. I could mix up your chemicals or file your papers or whatever. Anything."
Mia hesitated. "I can't afford an assistant."
"You don't have to pay me. I'll do it for free."
"Please." Izzy was not used to asking favors, but something in her voice told Mia that this was a need, not a want.
"Whatever needs doing, I'll do it. Please."
Mia looked down at Izzy. This wayward, wild, fiery girl suddenly gone timid and dampened and desperate. She reminded Mia oddly of herself at around that age, traipsing through the neighborhood, climbing over fences and walls in search of the right photograph, defiantly spending her mother's money on film, single-minded almost to excess. Something inside Izzy reached out to something in her and caught fire.
"All right," Mia said, and opened the door wider to let Izzy inside.
8. Izzy's newfound fascination with Mia proved lasting. Instead of sequestering herself in her bedroom with her violin, she would walk the mile and a half to the house on Winslow right after school, where Mia would be hard at work. She would watch Mia, learning to frame a shot, develop film, make a print. Pearl, meanwhile, did the exact reverse, walking with Moody to his house, lounging in the sunroom with the three oldest Richardson children. Deep down, she was grateful to Izzy for diverting her mother's attention. For so many years, it had been only the two of them, and now, on the Richardson's big sofa, she stretched her legs out in luxurious satisfaction. At 5 o'clock, Izzy would hop into the passenger seat of the Rabbit, and Mia would drive them both to the Richardsons, where Izzy would perch at the end of the kitchen counter and Mia would prepare dinner, listening intently to her daughter and the others in the next room. Only when Mia headed home, with Pearl in the passenger seat this time, would Izzy join her siblings and slump onto the couch beside them.
"Someone's got a little crush on Mia," Lexi sing-songed. And Izzy rolled her eyes and went upstairs. But crush was perhaps the right term. Izzy hung on Mia's every word, sought and trusted her opinion on everything. Along with the basics of photography, she began to absorb Mia's aesthetics and sensibilities. When she asked Mia how she knew which images to put together, Mia shook her head. "I don't," she said. This is how I figure out what I think." She waved a hand at the X-Acto knife on the table, the photograph she was carefully cutting apart. A line of cars speeding across the Lorraine Carnegie Bridge, beneath the watchful eyes of the two huge statues carved into the bridge's pillars. She had meticulously excised each car, leaving only its shadow. "I don't have a plan, I'm afraid," she said, lifting the knife again. "But then no one really does, no matter what they say." "My mother does. She thinks she has a plan for everything."
"I'm sure that makes her feel better."
"She hates me."
"Oh, Izzy, I'm sure that's not true."
"No, she does. She hates me.
That's why she picks on me and not any of the others. Mia had, since starting to work at the Richardsons, noted the peculiar dynamic between Izzy and the rest of her family, especially her mother. Truth be told, her mother was harsher on Izzy, always criticizing her behavior, always less patient with her mistakes and her shortcomings. She seemed to hold Izzy to a higher standard than her other children, to demand more from her, yet at the same time to overlook her successes in favor of her faults. Izzy, Mia noticed, tended to respond by needling her mother even more, pushing her buttons with the expertise only a child could. "Izzy," she said now, "I'll tell you a secret. A lot of times, parents are not the best at seeing their children clearly. There's so much wonderful about you." She gave Izzy's elbow a little squeeze and swept a handful of scraps into the garbage, and Izzy beamed. During those afternoons, when it was just the two of them, it was easy for Izzy to pretend that Mia was her mother, that the bedroom down the hallway was hers, and that when night fell, she would go into it and sleep, and wake in the morning. That Pearl, a mile and a half away, watching television with her own brothers and sister, did not exist. That this life belonged to her, Izzy, and her alone. In the evenings back at home, with jazz screeching from Moody's room and Alanis Morissette wailing from Lexi's and Tripp's stereo providing a thumping undercurrent of bass, Izzy would imagine herself in the house on Winslow, lying in bed reading, perhaps, or maybe writing a poem. Mia out in the living room working late into the night. There were many convoluted routes into this fantasy. She and Pearl had been accidentally switched at birth years ago. She had been taken home by her parents, who were therefore not her parents, and this was why no one in her family seemed to understand her, why she seemed so different from them all. Now, in her carefully spun dreams, she was reunited with her true mother. "I knew I'd find you someday," Mia would say. Everyone in the Richardson family noticed Izzy's improved demeanor. "She's almost pleasant around you," Lexi told Mia one day. Izzy's adoration for Mia, like everything she did not come by halves. There was nothing Izzy wouldn't do for her, and she soon found something she was sure that Mia really wanted. In mid-November, Pearl and Moody, along with the rest of their modern European history class, had gone to the art museum to look at paintings. The docent giving the class a tour was elderly and thin and looked as if all the juice had been sucked out of him through a straw via his pursed mouth. He disliked high school groups. Teens didn't listen. Teens could pay attention to nothing but the sexuality billowing off each other like steam. Velázquez, he thought. Some still lifes, maybe some Caravaggio. Definitely no nudes. He led them the long way around to the Italian wing, through the main hall with its tapestries and suits of armor in glass cases. The students themselves, however, paid little attention to the art, as students on field trips generally do. Andy Keene poked Jessica Kleinman between the shoulder blades and pretended each time it wasn't him. Clayton Booth and David Shern talked about football, the Raiders' chances against St. Ignatius in the upcoming game. Jenny Levy and Tanisha McDowell studiously ignored Jason Graham and Dante Samuels, who were tallying and evaluating the naked breasts in the paintings the docent hurried them past. Moody, who loved art, was watching Pearl and wishing, not for the first time, that he were a photographer, so that he could capture the way the light from the frosted glass gallery ceiling hit her upturned face and made it glow. Pearl herself, though she tried to focus on the docent's withered lecture, found her mind drifting. She stepped, sideways, into the next gallery over, a special, curated exhibit on the theme of Madonna and Child. From across the room, Moody, dutifully taking notes on a Caravaggio, watched her go. When she didn't return after 3, 4, 5 minutes, he slid his pencil into the spiral of his notebook and followed. It was a small room, with only a few dozen pieces on the wall, all showing the Virgin with Jesus on her lap. Some were medieval paintings in gilt frames hardly bigger than CD jewel cases. Some were rough pencil sketches of Renaissance statues. Some were larger-than-life oil paintings.
One was a postmodern collage of photos from celebrity gossip mags. The Virgin had the head of Julia Roberts, Jesus the head of Brad Pitt. But the piece that had transfixed Pearl was a photograph, a black-and-white print, 8x10, of a woman on a sofa beaming down at the newborn in her arms. It was unmistakably Mia. "But how," Moody began.
"I don't know."
They stared at the photo for some time in silence. Moody, ever practical, began gathering information. The title of the piece, according to the card beside it, was Virgin and Child Number 1, 1982. The artist was Pauline Hawthorne. He jotted these down in his notebook beneath his abandoned Caravaggio notes. There were no curator comments other than a note that the photo had been lent for the exhibit by the Ellsworth Gallery in Los Angeles. Pearl, on the other hand, focused on the photograph itself. There was her mother, looking a bit younger, a bit thinner, but with the same waifish build, the same high cheekbones and pointed chin. There was a tiny mole just underneath her eye, the scar that slashed like a white thread through her left eyebrow. There were her mother's slender arms, which looked so fragile and bird-like, as if they might snap under too great a weight, but which could carry more than any woman Pearl had ever seen. Even her hair was the same, piled in the same careless bundle right at the crown of her head. Beauty rolled off her in waves, like heat. The very image of her in the photograph seemed to glow. She wasn't looking at the camera. She was focused, totally and utterly absorbed, on the infant before her. "On me," Pearl thought. She was sure it was her in the photo. What other baby would her mother be holding? There were no photos of herself as an infant, but she recognized herself in this child, in the bridge of the nose and the corners of the eyes, in the tight, bald fists she had continued to make into toddlerhood and childhood, which in her concentration, without realizing it, she was making even now. Where had this photo come from? The grayscale sofa on which her mother sat might be tan, or pale blue, or even canary. The window behind her looked out onto a blurred view of tall buildings. The person who'd taken it had been mere feet away, as if seated on an armchair just beside the couch. Who had it been?
"Miss Warren," Mrs. Jacoby said behind her. "Mr. Richardson."
Pearl and Moody spun around, their faces prickling with heat.
"If you are both ready to move on, the entire class is waiting for you."
And indeed, the entire class was gathered outside, notebooks closed now, dutifully chaperoned by the docent, giggling and whispering as Moody and Pearl emerged. On the bus ride back home, jokes began to circulate about what Moody and Pearl had been doing. Moody turned a deep crimson and slouched down in his seat, pretending not to hear. Pearl gazed out the window, oblivious. She said nothing at all until the bus reached the oval around the school, and the students began to file out. "I want to go back," she said to Moody as they stepped off the bus. And they did. That afternoon after school, persuading Lexi to drive them because there was no good way to get there otherwise, and letting Izzy tag along because the moment she heard Mia and photograph, she insisted on coming with them. Moody, who had done the persuading, hadn't told Lexi what they wanted to see, and when they stepped into the gallery, her mouth fell open.
"Wow," she said. "Pearl, that's your mom."
The four of them surveyed the photograph. Lexi from the middle of the room as if she needed distance for a better view. Moody nearly smudging it with his nose as if he might find the answer between the pixels, and leaning so close that he set off a warning alarm. Pearl simply stared, and Izzy stood transfixed by the image of Mia. In the photo, she was as luminous as the full moon on a clear night. "Virgin and Child Number 1," she read on the placard. And she allowed herself to imagine for a moment that the child in Mia's arms was her.
"That's so crazy," Lexi said at last. "God, that's so crazy. What's your mom doing in a photo in an art museum? Is she secretly famous?"
"The people in photos aren't famous," Moody put in.
the people who take them are. Maybe she was some famous artist's muse, like Patti Smith and Robert Mapplethorpe, or Edie Sedgwick and Andy Warhol. Lexi had taken an art history class at the museum the previous summer. She straightened up. "Well, let's ask her," she said. "We'll just ask her." And they did, as soon as they got home, trooping into the Richardson kitchen where Mia had just finished dressing a chicken for dinner. "Where have you all been?" she said as they came in. "I got here at 5 and no one was home." "We went to the art museum," Pearl began, and then hesitated. Something about this didn't feel right to her. The same uneasy feeling you had when you set your foot on a wobbly step just before it dipped beneath you. Moody and Izzy and Lexi clustered around her, and she saw how they must look to her mother, flushed and wide-eyed and curious. Lexi nudged her in the back. "Ask her."
"Ask me what?"
Mia set the chicken into a casserole dish and went to the sink to wash her hands.
And Pearl, with the feeling of stepping off a very high diving board, plunged ahead. "There's a photo of you," she blurted out, "at the art museum. A photo of you on a couch holding a baby." Mia's back was still to them, the water rushing over her hands, but all four of the children saw it, a slight stiffening of her posture, as if a string had been tightened. She did not turn around, but kept on scrubbing at the gaps between her fingers. "A photo of me, Pearl? In an art museum?" she said. "You just mean someone who looks like me."
"It was you," Lexi said. "It was definitely you. With that little dot under your eye and the scar in your eyebrow and everything."
Mia touched a knuckle to her brow as if she'd forgotten the scar existed, and a drop of warm, sudsy water ran down her temple. Then she rinsed her hands and shut off the faucet.
"I suppose it could have been me," she said.
She turned around and began to dry her hands briskly on the dish towel. And to Pearl's chagrin, her mother's face was suddenly stiff and closed in. It was disorienting, like seeing a door that had always been open suddenly shut. For a moment, Mia did not look like her mother at all. You know, photographers are always looking for models. Lots of the art students did it.
"But you'd remember," Lexi insisted. "You were sitting on a couch in a nice apartment, and Pearl was on your lap. The photographer was..."
She turned to Moody.
"What's her name?"
"Hawthorne. Pauline Hawthorne."
"Pauline Hawthorne,"
Lexi repeated, as if Mia might not have heard.
"You must remember it."
Mia shook the dish towel out with a quick snap of her wrist. "Lexi, I really can't remember all the odd jobs I've done," she said. "You know, when you're hard up, you do a lot of things just to try and make ends meet. I wonder if you can imagine what that's like." She turned back to the sink and hung the towel to dry, and Pearl realized she'd gone about this all wrong. She should never have asked her mother like this, in the Richardson kitchen with its granite countertops and its stainless steel fridge and its Italian terracotta tiles, in front of the Richardson kids in their bright, buoyant North Face jackets, especially in front of Lexi, who still had the keys to her Explorer dangling from one hand. If she'd waited until they were alone, back at home in the dim little kitchen in their half a house on Winslow Road, perched on their mismatched chairs at the one remaining leaf of their salvage table, perhaps her mother would have told her. Already she saw her mistake. This was a private thing, something that should have been kept between them, and by including the Richardsons, she had breached a barrier that should not have been broken. Now, looking at her mother's set jaw and flat eyes, she knew there was no sense in asking any more questions. Lexi, for her part, was satisfied with Mia's explanation.
"Ironic, isn't it?" she said as they left the kitchen, shrugging. And Pearl let it go without even bothering to tell her that that wasn't what ironic meant. She was happy to let the matter drop.
On the drive home and for the rest of the evening, her mother was strangely silent, and she regretted ever bringing it up. Pearl had always been aware of money. In their circumstances, how could she not? But she had never before contemplated what it must have been like for her mother with an infant trying to scrape by.
She wondered what else her mother had done to survive, so that they both could survive those early years. She had never in her life gone to bed without Mia coming to kiss her goodnight, but that night she did. And Mia sat in the living room in a puddle of light, her face still shut, lost in thought. The following morning, Pearl was relieved when she came into the kitchen and Mia was there, making toast as usual, and carrying on as if the previous day had not happened. But the matter of the photograph lingered in the air like a bad smell, and Pearl tucked her questions into the back corner of her mind and resolved to say nothing more about it, at least for now. "Should I make some tea?" she asked. Izzy, however, was determined to find answers. It was clear this photograph held some secret about Mia, and she promised herself that she would unravel it. As a freshman, she had no free periods, but she devoted several lunch periods to research in the library. She looked up Pauline Hawthorne in the card catalog and found a few books on art history. Apparently, she had been quite well known. "A pioneer of modern American photography," one book called her. Another called her Cindy Sherman before Cindy Sherman was Cindy Sherman. At this point, Izzy took a brief detour to look up Cindy Sherman and spent so long perusing her photographs she was nearly late to class. Pauline Hawthorne's work, she learned, was known for its immediacy and its intimacy, for interrogating images of femininity and identity. "Pauline Hawthorne paved the way for me and other women photographers," Cindy Sherman herself said in one profile. Izzy pored over the reproductions of her photographs. Her favorite was a shot of a housewife and her daughter on a swing, the child kicking her legs so hard the chains bent in an arc, defying gravity, the woman's arms outstretched as if to push her child away or desperate to pull her back. The photos stirred feelings she couldn't quite frame in words, and this, she decided, must mean they were true works of art. She combed every entry for Pauline Hawthorne she'd found in the card catalog until she had accumulated the basic facts of her life. Born in 1947 in New Jersey, attended Garden State College, exhibited her first works in New York City in 1970, had her first solo show in 1972. Her photographs, Izzy learned, had been some of the most sought after in the 1970s. The encyclopedia entry had a photograph of Pauline Hawthorne herself, a slender woman with large dark eyes and silvery hair and a no-nonsense bob. She looked like someone's math teacher. Pauline Hawthorne, she learned, had died of brain cancer in 1982. Izzy settled herself at one of the two computers in the library, waited for the modem to connect, and typed Pauline's name into Alta Vista. She found more photographs. The Getty had one, MoMA had three, a few articles analyzing her work, an obituary from the New York Times. Nothing else. She tried the public library, both branches, found a few more photography books and several articles on microfiche, but they added nothing new. What was the connection between Pauline Hawthorne and Mia? Perhaps Mia had simply been a model, like she said. Maybe she'd just happened to sit